If you want it straight. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you may be. In talking to you tonight, we shall try to do two things which are by no means easy. The first is to set before you in chronological order the history of the communist conspiracy from 1776 to the present time. And the second is to condense those 2 centuries of history into 3 hours of narration. We ask for your sympathy, therefore, with regard to our shortcomings and your patience with regard to the time. We shall do our best to keep you interested. And we take it for granted that nobody came here to be entertained, but for much more serious reasons. For the story we shall unfold is of immense importance, not just of abstract importance to the American people as a whole, but of direct, immediate, and vital concern to each of you as an individual. What is very definitely involved in this picture is the freedom and the lives of yourselves and your families, not in some distant decades, but in the very near and quite foreseeable future. Above all, this is a true story in every particular. In such a tenuous outline of so vast a subject, we cannot spare the time for documentation. We cannot even go into an explanation of the background, which would be helpful with regard to many statements that may startle or disturb you. In fact, we shall tear many such statements boldly from earlier materials already published by ourselves without pausing to give you the surrounding context, nor even to name the source. As we keep on moving down the years, however, and you find these items from the past meshing so neatly into a total design with the present pattern which you already recognize, most of your doubts about the earlier history will probably disappear. But the main point we wish to make here is that many dedicated men have spent years in uncovering, verifying, and fitting together the pieces that form the astounding mosaic which we shall now be putting before you. And for those who wish either to prove things out for themselves or to read and study a great deal further in order to acquire a much deeper understanding of the conspiracy, a reading list of books and pamphlets has been prepared specifically to go with this presentation. And any member of our staff can give you a copy or tell you where one may be obtained. 11 years ago, we prepared a speech entitled, Look at the Score. After being delivered dozens of times, it was used as the opening part of our presentation in the 2-day meeting at which the John Birch Society was founded. Hence, it was then incorporated into the Blue Book of the Society, which was simply a transcript of that presentation. In that speech, we started our survey of the conspiracy at the point where the physical confrontation of the free world with the communists had begun. This was in 1917, when they established themselves in Soviet Russia as a visible headquarters from which to reach out their arms of expansion. We did so because we ourselves did not know, and our audiences were not ready to accept, as much about the earlier history of the conspiracy as is the case today. Everything we said in Look at the Score about the communist advance from 1917 until the date of the speech has held up as entirely accurate. We hope and believe that the same will prove to be true about all that we say now. For even then, it was perfectly obvious that when Lenin and Trotsky seized power in Russia in 1917, the conspiracy behind them had not sprung full-grown into existence only a year or two before. This time we go back to the real beginning, because at least an elementary knowledge of the earlier history of the conspiracy is vital to an understanding of what is happening at the present time. So, with that much necessary prelude, let us plunge into our task. 2. In Europe during the 18th century, there had been many esoteric groups with the same basic idea. Each one wanted to become the original nucleus of an expanding secret society which would keep on growing until someday it ruled the world. Most important of these ambitious groups was the Order of the Illuminati, founded by Adam Weishaupt in Bavaria on May 1, 1776. This, incidentally, is why, about 100 years later, the socialist organizations of Europe made May 1 the International Red Holiday, which it has remained to the present time. Their leaders were honoring the birthday of the whole vast conspiratorial movement of which they themselves were a part. The strategy of Weishaupt's order calls for nothing less than the destruction of all religion, of all governments, and of all previously existing human institutions, out of the chaos, anarchy, suffering, and confusion thus to be created, the conspirators were to develop their new order. They did not mind in the least if this plan brought about a hell on earth, so long as Weishaupt and his Illuminati, or their respective successors, could wind up as its Lucifer and his court. We know that this seems hard to believe for those who have not delved into these dark caves of history. Not only are the facts fully documented and indisputable, however, but the most ample proof lies in the visible recurrence from time to time during the last 200 years of this same plan being vigorously prosecuted and its remarkable success over the past two generations, as we shall see in due course. So let us repeat this point for emphasis. Simply remember that the underlying, unchanging objective of the total conspiracy is to destroy all religion, all traditional forms of government, and all the organizational bases of our whole civilization. And then note how many of the sinister activities you see going on all around you are insidiously but effectively serving that purpose. The first great destructive strike of this group at the old order was the French Revolution. Their extremely foul and significant role in bringing about that Holocaust and in making it such a memorable horror have been well known to honest students of history for a long time. But the French Revolution itself proved to be premature from the ambitious point of view of the conspirators. They simply did not yet have the organizational reach and power to extend what they had created into a destructive worldwide upheaval of the same kind. A returning flood of decency, of tradition, of compassion, and of common sense soon caused the terror of the French Revolution to recede. And then, during 20 years of the Napoleonic Wars, there was, in appearance, such a gradual return to normalcy that the Allied monarchs who sent Bonaparte to exile in St. Helena restored a Bourbon to the throne of France. But under the surface, things were not what they seemed, and never would be again, at least for the next 200 years. For Weishaupt's circle of conspirators had come through the revolution more firmly entrenched than before, and with far wider reach. So much so that by 1798, only 22 years after the group had been founded, a very well-traveled and well-informed scholar named John Robison and a devoutly religious cleric, the Abbe Barrowell, both wrote books to warn the world, and especially its governments, of the international power and permeation which the Illuminati already had so cunningly and so secretly achieved. Even in faraway America, their infiltration into positions of influence had become a whispered scandal. In October 1798, George Washington, in a letter to a friend, expressed his concern over the spread in the United States of the diabolical tenets of the Illuminati and the pernicious principles of Jacobinism if, as he said, they are susceptible of separation. And a book exposing some of the ramifications of this conspiracy was published in Charleston, South Carolina in 1802. But the secrecy of the organization was gradually becoming tighter. And although their presence could always be felt behind the scenes, the history of the group itself became more and more shadowy. We do not know for sure whether or not for a while there may have been a splintering of the oligarchy into rival conspiratorial groups, or whether, on the other hand, Weishaupt's order may have remained intact and simply have absorbed into its ranks some rival organizations which did get underway, or whether several parallel groups were eventually consolidated into one. There is no need for guessing at knowledge we do not have, because what is known is ample for our purposes. We do know, for instance, that by 1798, and from then on until 1815, the insiders of this conspiracy were establishing themselves in positions of power within the governments and the institutions on both sides of the battle lines that had been drawn by the ambition of Napoleon. This ambivalence was a cardinal policy of the early Illuminati, since it was their very purpose to destroy all governments, including their own, and replace such outdated remnants with a one-world tyranny run by themselves. All displays of patriotism on their part were but a pretense for the public and a joke among themselves. And necessarily, of course, this policy has become and remained an equally firm principle for all of their successors. We also know that by 1848, the conspiracy was cohesive enough, powerful enough, and with sufficient reach to have brought off the various revolutions and uprisings of that year almost simultaneously in several countries. And at the same time, a revolutionary action arm of the conspiracy, known as the Communist Movement, came out more or less openly on the scene with an announcement of its existence, its methods, and its purposes. This was done through the publication, also in 1848, of the Communist Manifesto. So far as we know, it was a group of the conspiracy calling themselves the League of Just Men, who felt the urgent need for a codification of the strategy, the tactics, and the aims that were being followed. So they commissioned a young intellectual hack named Karl Marx to prepare this synthesis for them. He did so with the help of a wealthy fellow revolutionary and close friend, Friedrich Engels. Contrary to the impression which has been so carefully created since, there was almost nothing original on the part of Marx and Engels in this document. Their names did not even appear on any printed copy of the manifesto when it first came out, or for at least 20 years thereafter. This was strictly a party platform, as Dr. Stefan Passoni has labeled it, for the guidance of the communist movement in the future. And the total conspiracy, of which this communist movement was only one instrumentality, was even then already in the 72nd year of its satanic progress. But the communist arm was eventually to become so important a part of the total revolutionary and destructive apparatus that today it is frequently confused and equated with the body as a whole. The manifesto and the other events of 1848 did clearly mark the beginning of a new era in the history of the conspiracy. So we ourselves had better take a fresh start at this point in our study of that history. Section 3. Before we go further, therefore, it seems best to deal with some questions which may be stirring in your minds. And we'll try to save time by not only supplying answers which serve for the period we have covered, but by applying this basic clarification to all the stages of the expanding conspiracy right up to the present time. For we may thus clear the way for an easier and better understanding of many surprising developments we shall need to record. For that purpose, we need once more to go back to the beginning. Adam Weishaupt and his ablest associates not only succeeded in gathering princes and potentates and bankers and diplomats into the upper echelons of their conspiracy, but Weishaupt laid down for his fellow conspirators the policy that they should always go after the sons of the powerful, the rich, and the famous to become members of his order. And that policy has been followed faithfully ever since. It accounts for the surprising circumstance that a preponderant majority of all these power-seeking megalomaniacs in the upper echelons of the conspiracy in any country always come and still come from the very top economic, social, educational, and political circles of that country. This was true for the 70 years before the communist movement even began to take shape in the 1840s. It has remained equally true throughout all of the 125 years since that time, while the communist arm was becoming so important and useful a part of the total conspiracy. A great many members of the oligarchy have been recruited into the lower fringes of the conspiratorial apparatus, frequently while in college, without ever having gone through the communist route at all. They are taken into the broad fraternal circle because of the money or prestige or fame of their fathers or their families, and sometimes because of their own early brilliance. For with them come the basic ingredients of power, which can thus be added to the total strength and resources of the conspiracy. The result that concerns us, therefore, is that most of the really top conspirators, whom for convenience we call the insiders, have never had a Communist Party card, nor ever seen a communist cell. Many of them were originally brought into the conspiratorial clique through misguided idealism, again, exactly as planned by Adam Weishaupt. But by the time they learned the whole truth about the organization of which they were a part, it was too late to get out. Also, by that time, they had been brought, through clever and continuous psychological molding, to a different outlook themselves. For the neophytes who cannot be so molded are simply dropped before they ever learn too much about the real nature of the club. Among those who do gradually climb further into the upper and inner circles of the conspiracy, however, there is no slightest trace of idealism left. Cynicism has become their religion, the pursuit of wealth or power or position has become their goal, and opportunism within the permitted boundaries has become the guide for their energies and their actions. For this conspiratorial oligarchy long ago became the greatest exemplar of the "you scratch my back and I scratch yours" principle of advancement that the world has ever known. Once conscience has been discarded in favor of ruthless ambition, these converts to the conspiracy have come to realize how the tremendous and pervasive influence of the insiders and now of the communist machinery which the insiders control can pave the way for their own acquisitions of more riches or fame or more prestige and success within their chosen fields. And especially does this backing provide the means of acquiring more and more power during their own lifetimes for those who want power most. All that these opportunists must offer in exchange for so much help up the ladder is unswerving support of that drive for ultimate world rule on the part of the total conspiracy, which gives it direction and cohesiveness. By ruthless devotion to this central aim, the more ambitious members of the oligarchy climb into higher and tighter circles of the pyramidal structure above them as they personally grow more cunning, more hypocritical, more cold-blooded, more powerful, and more proudly conscious of the power that they possess and wield. A quick but contemporary illustration may be helpful. Friends used to say to us about Christian Herter, "Look, this man has been a congressman, then governor of Massachusetts, and finally secretary of state. Why on earth would he want to be a communist? What would he have to gain?" To which the answer was very easy. "You have the cart before the horse, my friend. It's because Christian Herter had been a member of the conspiracy and had worked for the communist cause all of his life, ever since he had been one of Colonel House's boys at the Versailles Conference, that he was helped and enabled to become a congressman, then governor, and at last a secretary of state. This is the way the game is played by and for the insiders. Of course, there are some of these ambitious and ruthless characters who do begin their careers as communists. These are the ones that have sufficient ability and determination and who gradually gain a sufficient grasp of the true picture to rise above their cannon fodder estate and climb into some level of the conspiratorial circles above. And of course, these few that do have what it takes are welcomed because they add strength and drive and cunning to the total force of the conspiracy. But your true insiders, whether with communist backgrounds or coming out of famous families through Ivy League colleges almost directly into the upper circles, all acquire one attitude in common. They have only contempt and a merciless scorn for the poor deluded fools who, carrying out the plans and orders of these insiders themselves, dynamite churches or burn stores or build barricades in the streets in the name of revolution. These inside masters of the game who foment, finance, control, and manipulate all of these revolutionary activities usually remain entirely aloof and above such plebeian performances. For they are well aware that communism, far from being a spontaneous uprising of the suffering masses against bosses who exploit them, is actually imposed on every country from the top down, and that all the pretense of mass uprisings and revolution has to be created artificially, especially in a country like the United States, by incessant agitation, propaganda, coercion, and cajolery. They also know that the condition of the people, both materially and spiritually, in any country where communist rule has been established, is always worse than it was before. But this is of no concern to the insiders. Their only goal and interest is power for themselves at any price. As reluctant as we are to mention names, it will certainly clarify the picture if we cite a few examples of contemporary figures whom we believe to be insiders, or to have been insiders while they were alive. We would apply this description without hesitation, for instance, to John Foster Dulles, Christian Herter, Nelson Rockefeller, Henry Ford II, and Henry Cabot Lodge. We believe it is extremely unlikely that any of these men ever had a Communist Party card, or attended a Communist cell meeting, or considered himself to be a Communist. Yet in every case, the record is absolutely clear and can be documented beyond all room for doubt that each of these men has worked, or did work, steadily, cunningly, and ruthlessly for the Communist cause during all of his adult career. Just as their earlier prototypes in the conspiracy, 150 years ago, before the Communist movement was inaugurated, worked steadily to promote the cause of revolutionary destructiveness without soiling their own hands in the riots and the massacres. This has been the story ever since the formula was established by Adam Weishaupt. It has explained the motivation and the actions of the top-level individual conspirators from the French Revolution days of such incredibly foul members of the Illuminati as Mirabeau and the Duke of Orleans, right up to the even more merciless drives for power of Robert Strange McNamara and Milton Eisenhower. So let's go back now to the point where we interrupted our chronological sequence and outlined the advance of the conspiracy after 1848, during those decades when the Communist movement was still only one division of the army which was attacking all the bastions of civilization. For during the latter half of the 19th century, the inner circle of this total conspiracy set up or took over, guided and worked through many subversive groups and organizations of many kinds all over Europe and America. These groups were busily engaged in promoting riots, revolution, class hatred, bitterness between all natural divisions of the human race, socialist legislation, collectivist propaganda, and in all of the activities which today we ascribe to the worldwide communist parties. But in those days, the communist movement had not yet become even the most important instrumentality of the conspiracy, and much less something to be mistakenly equated with it. These agencies of destruction included the anarchists, the nihilists, the syndicalists of various shades, and several others, besides, of course, the communists themselves. They varied in makeup and method from the revived Carbonari, used by Albert Pike and Garibaldi and Mazzini as revolutionary guerrillas and stormtroops, to the oh-so-learned professors like Adolf Wagner, who started Germany down the road to socialism under Bismarck, and the oh-so-socially acceptable Fabian Society in England. Each of them appeared to be independently following its own path of crime or pressure or propaganda, while actually each of them was carrying out some divisional task for the destruction of the entire old order of civilization. Even though most of the members of some of these groups had no more idea of what they were really about than do the misguided idealists today who have been beguiled into supporting the so-called civil rights movement. Wherever you might have dug deeply enough under the surface of all the criminal turmoil and collectivist indoctrination during the half century after 1848, you would have found the brains and the hands of the Illuminati insiders fomenting and guiding all of these activities which benefited their long-range program. If all of this, too, seems hard to believe, let's pause long enough to look at just one revealing and convincing illustration out of dozens that are available. And we'll bring the whole matter closer home by taking the Haymarket riot in Chicago, right here in our own country, in 1888, for our example. In planning, in execution, and in purpose, it was very little different from the siege of the Bastille in France in 1789 or the attack on the police at the Democratic Convention in the United States in 1968. And they were all carried out by identically the same incredibly ruthless and destructive conspiracy. In this Haymarket affair, the police, being convinced after showing great patience that a mob of anarchists was being excited to an incendiary pitch, ordered the crowd to disperse. Instead, one member of the mob hurled a dynamite bomb with fuse burning into the ranks of the police. As a result of the explosion, and of the gun battle which then followed, 8 policemen were killed and 67 wounded. In general, the sinister international planning behind all such tragedies was completely ignored, and the riots themselves were accepted by press and people as simply sporadic outbreaks of criminally minded malcontents. We have exactly the same situation today when the riots on our campuses are described by Richard Nixon, Edward Kennedy, and many other political leaders as separate and spontaneous manifestations of the natural rebelliousness of youth without any central planning or agitation behind them, despite all the mountains of evidence to the contrary. But fortunately, after the Haymarket horror, Captain Michael J. Schock of the Chicago Police felt it was his duty to dig into every aspect of the tragedy which had killed and maimed so many of his fellow officers. After a year of very careful and extensive investigation, Captain Schock produced a monumental work published in 1889 under the title of Anarchy and Anarchists. The book runs to nearly 700 large printed pages and brings out with tremendous detail and documentation the sinister international planning, backing, and organization behind these murderous anarchists in just one American city. And we think it is worthwhile for us to quote a few extracts from the final pages of that magnificent study. Quote, "All over the world, the apostles of disorder, rapine, and anarchy are today pressing forward their work of ruin and preaching their gospel of disaster to all the nations with a more fiery energy and a better organized propaganda than was ever known before. People who imagine that the energy of the revolutionists has slackened, or that their determination to wreck all the existing systems has grown less bitter, are deceiving themselves." Parenthetically, please note that phrase, "their determination to wreck all the existing systems." Captain Schock had uncovered the goal of the insiders who ran this total conspiracy, to which all the efforts and activities of all their dupes and agents everywhere were unwaveringly directed.
Stop the cassette and turn it over for the continuation of the program on side 2.